This episode of Own the Gray is brought to you by I Am. Discover your unique talents, realize your potential, and align to your path. Take the first step to uncover your life purpose by visiting deborahjones.ca/courses. Welcome to Own the Gray, a podcast to dispel the notion that aging is undesirable and setting new positive attitudes. I'm Deborah Jones, and I believe you can be vibrant and healthy throughout the best years of your life. You are a contrarian, and that's probably a term that I should have been calling myself all these years, because it's somebody that goes against the norm. Would you like to explain to us what it means to you?
Yeah, I don't know what the norm is. And I think that's probably why I had to find some sort of a name that defines who I am. The problem, I think, what most people would call the social mantra, and that would be that you go to school, study hard, go to college, graduate, get a job, work 40 years, retire, and then go off into the sunset. That never kind of worked for me. And part of the reason was that I come from Australia. I come from a town where I was raised in the 60s and the 70s, where there was no technology like we have today, like internet and so on. And I think that that sort of defines a different kind of cultural experience. Everything was peer-to-peer. It was human-to-human community. And in that world, having a degree in a profession meant very little, because it was more about, well, what can I offer my community? What innate skills do I have? And if I don't have any at a young age, what can I do to develop those skills? My experiences are kind of unusual. I fell into the world of technology when I was in my teenage years. And this is in the 70s, when there really was no such thing as a personal computer. I, in fact, bought the very first ever personal computer that ever came to Australia in about 1977, 78. And I was that geek in his bedroom learning how these things worked. And there was no one who could teach you anything, because we were on the forefront. Mm-hmm. And I think that taught me that from a very young age, if I was going to learn something, I had to do it myself. And I've worked 40 years in that industry, and I saw it grow and change and evolve. And I saw the effect on humanity that it had, positive and negative, because I've seen all sides of that story. And then I realized at the end of the day that what got me through it, and I mean, I did well out of that industry, but I was never rich in that term of, you know, one percenters or whatever. I was never that guy. There was always somebody like a Bill Gates or a Mark Zuckerberg or whatever who wanted to have the mantle for that. But for every one of those, there were 10 or 100,000 regular geeks that weren't like that. And the reality is very, very few of them were to be rich from it. Now I find myself at the tail end of work. I realize that that entropy means that the senior, with all of the experience, has very, very, very little to offer the junior, because they're in a field where 2 years from now, whatever they're doing will be obsolete and they'll be doing something else anyway. And I wonder whether or not that's a sort of a philosophy which is applied to most things these days in the world, that we think we're building a, quote, career that we can retire on, or if you're a business person, you're building a business, you'll sell it for $1 million to somebody one day. And most people who find themselves going down that alleyway, they don't like what they get at the end of it. When I was 22, I had my own business. I was doing very well in this sort of world. I came face to face with my father passing away. My mother called me one night and said, "Dad's had a heart attack." I ran to the house. I got there. He was gone in the ambulance. I got to the hospital, and there he was, dead. And I had to go through, as a 22-year-old kid, when you come face to face with that, it's not only the shock, but when you get over the shock and then you become the guy who has to go through his desk and his affairs and how he lived his life, and you have to piece together the financial picture for my mother, because she needed money and so on. And you put all that together, what I found, what I did not like. I found a man who was a good man, who had raised me, who had raised his, you know, had been a great husband, had done everything right. He worked for the same company for 40 years. He did all of that. And when I pieced together the end result of that, there wasn't much to show for it, other than the fact that he had worked for a corporation for all those years in that were in the, involved in building roofing materials. And for the vast majority of his career, he was working with Blue Asbestos. And that company did not know the I'm sure they did know the carcinogenic impact of asbestos on lungs, but he died only 2 years after he retired from a heart attack from complications of lung cancer that was given to him when he left his company. And when I put these pieces together, it was like, there but for the grace of God, you know, go I am not following my father's footsteps. And as so many of my friends, you know, they had parents who were doctors, and so they went to medical school or, you know, something like that. Mm-hmm. I did the polar opposite. After my mother was settled down and after a few years had passed and everything seemed to be copacetic again, I got on a plane, I came to California, and I moved away from my home country, my home city, and I wanted to start my life all over again, and I did, and that helped craft me. But when I came to the United States, having 25 years in another country that thought differently and acted differently, and with all of these experiences of wisdom at such a young age, when I landed in LAX and I started to see what was going on about me, and I eventually went into the workforce and I had, you know, lunches with friends and they tell you about what was on their mind, what were concerning them, I looked at the whole thing and I saw my father. And I'm like, you're taking this crappy job you're working at for 50 hours a week, battling through LA jungle commute every day, an hour in, an hour out. You're stressed out. You've lost yourself in the process. Why? So that you can have health insurance to keep your family safe. That's your rationale. And that was the story they all told me. And I looked at it and I said, there's a problem here. And I again reject this social mantra. Mm-hmm. And that's how I became a contrarian.
That makes total sense. And I'm sure there's a lot of people listening that can see themselves in that story. And from listening to how you feel still about that way of life, that it isn't really a way of life, it's kind of going through life blindly, is what I'm hearing you say. You have discovered that there are different ways for us to live our life. You have a different philosophy. And on your website, you talk about the four phases that we go through. And I think it's very important for people who have seen the big picture to actually explain it to those of us that don't see it yet. So with that, what could you summarize as far as those phases of life? What did you discover?
Well, everything is in balance in the universe, and we need to be as well. So that'll be the summation of what I get. Now, let me tell you how I get to that point. When I looked at life, I looked at my father's experience, and I looked at all my friends' experiences. And as I got older, I'm 57 now, I look back at my own experiences. And I realized that it's very, very hard, particularly at a young age, to understand the net effect of actions that you take in youth. And, you know, the obvious one thing was kid wants to go get a tattoo. Well, okay, you're going to be living with it for the rest of your life. Do you realize the true cost of that burden? Well, they don't. But at that time, it's like, I'm immortal. I can do anything, you know, punk rock the world and let's just go and do it. Well, fair enough. I did that too. But what if somebody had just told me what the net effect of this was in a way that wasn't preachy, wasn't trying to, you know, force it down my throat, but somebody who just said, if you want to have more information, here's a little few things you might want to consider, I probably would have taken that up. And that's kind of how I've approached it. I realized that life, so the first thing I looked at was the totality of life. And that is, how many years do we live, really? There's two ways of looking at that. You can look at it from a physiological, human, or spiritual perspective, and you can look at it from a financial, you know, legal perspective. I guess you'd call it right brain and left brain. If we look at it purely from the left brain, because numbers can easily be quantified, the average life expectancy, according to the CDC in the United States for a US male currently is 75.5 years. It is not the numbers that your government is telling you it is. When they say, oh, we live longer because, you know, technology and all this medical, no. We do not. 75.5 years is the average US male life expectancy. And the interesting thing about that number is that only 5 short years ago, that number was almost 80. The numbers for females in the same category are proportionally identical. So whereas it used to be about 82 years, it's dropped down to 77. For males, it used to be about 80, it's dropped to 75. We are not living longer. Now, you could say, oh, there's COVID and there's, you know, these numbers were at 76.3 years in 2019. So COVID hasn't had a massive effect on this. Problem is we live a really, really low-grade lifestyle. We do not eat healthy. We reject nature for urbanization and for technology. And as a result, nature has a way of kicking us in the pants. So I start with that number. So I said, well, let's look at life over that lifespan. And let's say, let's go with 80 because it's an easy divider. Let's break it up into four quarters. What does each quarter represent to us in our lives? Because as we go through them, we can have decisions knowing a little bit about what might be coming along in the future. Mm-hmm. So the first quarter is when we are born. We learn to talk, we learn to walk, we learn to socialize, we learn to learn. And the idea of at the end of that in our teenage years is we hope we're not so, you know, nasty and a toxic waste of a person to enter the world. But that's our first quarter. And most of it is under the umbrella of our parents. So we are somewhat protected from the world, but to some degree towards the tail end of that, we are thrust out of the nest and into the world at some point.
Got it.
The second quarter is what I would call the building quarter. And this is the quarter where we build a life. We build an identity, a family, a house, a career. We build things that make us us. We build our id. And with that, it's a very, if you ever do anything in terms of business and you understand what new ventures are like and how you capitalize a new venture, you realize that it's very capital intensive. If you were building a factory, you'd have to go and borrow a lot of money and break ground and build the work centers and the factory structure before you can produce product number one. And that's the exact same situation for most people in their second quarter. They have to heavily capitalize it up front, front load it. Then there's the third quarter, which I would call the optimization quarter. And that would be the what often is referred to by personal financial advisors as the peak earning years of your life. And the reason why it's structured that way is that at this point in time, you have more experience and more wisdom to be able to offer your employer. So you're considered to be more valuable. But you, on the other hand, need to be able to hunker down like the squirrel readying for the winter and start hoarding nuts. And nuts, in our case, is money, because that is the bloodline of our Western world. We don't exist because of food, shelter, clothing like we did back in the cave era. We now exist because of money, credit card debt, and mortgages. And so we need to be able to clean that up and have that flowing cleanly through our veins. So that optimization phase is about that and holding money back, saving. For the final quarter, which is our waning quarter, when our biological body starts giving out, our get the bad hip, the bad back, you know, the whole bit. And we just hope that we can last long enough to have as long a period of time as possible. But knowing realistically that the CDC is telling us we've got 75 years if you're a US male. So if you know the totality of that, if you've ever played any strategic war games or anything like that, you know, if you know the battlefield entirely, it's very easy to position yourself and to be able to mitigate risk and to be able to take advantage of opportunities. And what I see is that we are being told the polar opposite of that reality by our political leaders and our government, particularly in terms of things like Social Security, which is encouraging us to work until the age of 67 because they don't have that much money to last us, but they're not telling us that you'll only have 8 years to spend it. So therefore, it's an advantage to those that have the money, the pension plans and so on, for you to work as long as possible in your life before you retire, because they don't have the funds there to be able to sustain yourself. And they know these numbers because these are CDC numbers. These are not some think tank out of Texas. This is CDC numbers from the very same government that we trust to keep us safe from COVID or whatever. These are the guys telling us how long we're going to live. None of these numbers are getting to the politicians in Congress. So as individuals, for us, we have to be pragmatic, realistic, and we have to be willing to put fear aside and confront reality and then ask the very question, now what are we going to do about it? I found out from a very interesting study that the Boeing Corporation did back in, I think it was the late 90s, where they actually took an average worker and they're working out how much money do we need to fund our pension program for these guys when they leave. And so they did a study of life expectancy back then and worked out that if a worker worked until the age of 55 and then chose to retire, they had an average lifespan of 80 to 83 years, and therefore they would fund accordingly. But if the worker was encouraged to stay longer to the age of 65, do you know what the average lifespan was according to their pension program?
No.
They died at the age of 67 on average.
Wow.
Yeah. So you work an extra 10 years thinking you're amassing more wealth, but you have a net negative effect on how much time you're going to have to spend it. When I heard that story, I saw my father. He died at 67. I was giving that speech to a financial finance group here in Phoenix, and a lady came up to me after the speech, and I thought she was going to take me on with, you know, some sort of, no, that's all rubbish, blah, blah, blah. Like, I'm just quoting the BBC's articles on what Boeing had published. Mm-hmm. She comes up and she says, look, I want to introduce myself. I'm just a recently retired CFO. I worked at Honeywell Corporation. Honeywell here in Phoenix, where I live, is a big military contractor. Not unlike Boeing, not quite as big, but not unlike them. Mm-hmm. And she said, we did the exact same studies as Boeing did for our pension program. We got the exact same numbers.
Wow.
Yeah. This is factual data. This is real life. And the problem is that nobody is telling us this. So when we look to retirement as part of our natural calling, as part of our social mantra, and we think all through life that this is going to be how it's going to end, why is it that it doesn't work out that way for the vast, vast majority of people who enter retirement? Now, the other problem is, if you then take the four-quarter principle and you look at when you capitalize, for example, I mentioned in the second quarter, you're very capital intensive. The way you do this matters because we are all faced with two major enemies to our own freedom at the end of our lives or throughout our entire lives. And they both come from the same source, and that's banking. And the first one is the 18-year-old kid sitting at the kitchen table who gets a student loan contract put in front of them and the parents looking at it, proud of the kid who's going to go to some Ivy League college and, you know, it's going to be $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 of debt. But whatever, we don't care. He'll pay it off because he'll get a really good job and he'll pay it off really quickly. Yeah, that doesn't work. And what happens is that the kid takes on the debt contract. Most kids at the age of 18 aren't even legally allowed to buy a beer in a bar, and yet they're expected to sign that debt contract. And if they're lucky and they can pay it off, good for them. But the problem is by the time they get to the point where they actually have cash flow to be able to go and capitalize the other things in their second quarter, such as buying a house, not getting ripped off on a car, a vacation for their family or something like that, what they find is that the banks don't want to give them money because they're already paying off $1,000 a month or whatever it is on the student loan debt. What the net effect of that means is that people who would normally have bought real estate at, say, the age of 25 are now being pushed into having to buy it at the age of 35. Now, if an average mortgage, according to Standard Banking, is a 30-year experience, add it up with the start date, and that'll tell you when you finish paying off your house. And it does not necessarily coincide with your life expectancy because during that time, I will guarantee that 9 out of 10 mortgages get refinanced, cash out, HELOCs, everything that just extends that 30 years out. And most people end up going into retirement carrying a mortgage. And I guarantee, I'll quote Susie Orman on this one, you cannot retire if you've got a mortgage, period. You can't do it. So this is a setup. This is a setup that was known right from the start. And we are blindly just with faith going in and doing it because everybody else got a house. Everybody else went to college. Everybody else has got these problems. Why shouldn't I? That's where I reject it. And this is my whole reason.
Yeah. It's kind of astounding when you say the words and the reality of it hits. The first thing in my mind is, so what do we do? What can we do? And I guess that is why your Be Unconstrained website exists, because people are asking, okay, now what? And I noticed that you have certain things that you offer that, depending on where you are in your awareness and what it is you want to do. So originally, for the listeners, I was contacting Miles because I thought it would be good to talk about what to do in retirement. And Miles came back to me and said, well, if you're worrying about money in retirement, you've kind of lost the plot already. You shouldn't be worrying about money in retirement. So if there's anything that you can share with us when what you've just said hits home and we realize, shoot, I don't have a lot of time, I need to make some changes, where would you suggest we start looking?
There's one simple statement that will make sense to people if they just understand what it means and they don't reject it. And it's the statement, the rich don't have jobs. Just think about that. How many wealthy, rich people living on yachts in the Monaco Harbor with their French Riviera lifestyle and champagnes and caviar, how many of those people have a job? I'd say none of them. If that's the case, and we can point at them and, you know, say, oh, you rich people, you're evil, you're criminals, whatever. No, there's been rich people since the dawn of time. And the reality is they're not criminals. They just do things differently. So if we want to perpetuate this natural end result that we've been talking about and we want to guarantee it, then do the exact same thing you've always been doing, because you will guarantee it, right? Cause and effect.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
If you don't want to do that and you want to change things, then you have to look for alternative behaviors. And the best way to actually look to alternative behaviors is to look to end result, causal effect. In other words, look at what rich people do that gets them wealth. And the simple starting point is the rich don't have jobs. Okay, so just follow me through this thought process, because whether or not you reject it out of hand, say, oh, I can't have not job, I got a bills to pay, I got my mortgage, I got to, you know, put my kids through school, you know. Yeah, okay, you do, but the rich don't, right? So let's just put you aside and let's look at reality. What do the rich have? Why are they rich? They own assets. Right? They own businesses, real estate, fine art. They own Bitcoin. They own all of these things that are assets. And when they buy the asset, they typically buy it on the basis that it will pay them to own it. And so it's very simple. If you've got a lot of rental real estate, for example, and you've taken the rents from your tenants and you've used it to pay the mortgages off, mm-hmm. So you did 15-year mortgages, which is what I typically have done. After 15 years, all the rent comes to you. If you have 10 buildings or 20 rental units or whatever it is, all that money comes to you. Now you don't work. Now you're rich. The asset continues to go up in value. And at the end of the day, you enjoy the proceeds of the asset, the goose that lays the golden egg. Forevermore, it's yours. That's no different to a rich person. A rich person buys shares in some company and the company goes up. They get to enjoy the proceeds of that buy low, sell high experience. If a rich person buys the dividend stock that pays them every quarter to own them, there's tons of them out there. They get these nice checks just coming into their mailbox or in their bank account, and they didn't do squat to earn it. This is how we need to think. Everyone looks at this and go, it's too hard. It takes too long. I don't make enough money from these like cash flow things, you know. No, it's the bottom line is you're impatient, right? You're impatient. you're on this planet, go back to the four quarters, right? You're on this planet for 75 years. So what are you going to do after you've gone through 15 years of letting your tenant pay your rent off? Are you going to still have a life? Yeah, of course you are, right? And I guarantee one thing is if you get that chance to step off the working treadmill earlier, you'll have a longer life. Mm-hmm. So therefore do it with assets that are paying you to own them. Now, I've done that. This isn't theory. This isn't some stupid Instagram influencer talking to you. This is a guy who never finished high school, who left his home country and did this stuff because I rejected the social mantra. And now I'm a multimillionaire and I just buying property all over the world and having a whale of a time. And people look at me and go, tell me how. Well, I'll tell you what I did. I can't tell you how you can do it. That's on you. You've got to work that crap out. That's not my problem. That's your problem. But if you want me to give you my experience, then you have to understand the reason why I did these things goes all the way back to my childhood and goes all the way back to being raised on the other side of the planet in a country with very few people and a lot of nature. And most importantly, it goes back to the willingness to open your eyes and see the blind reality of what is going on in front of you and structure yourself around that. That's key. And these points of evidence are all about us. And I mean, I can give you so many examples of this that I've seen in my life that have changed the way that I behave, the way I react to things. And I look at it and there is a running theme, which I'm starting to understand 57 years later, mm-hmm. that seems to be common. But the reality is that we don't open our eyes to the what's going on about us in any way, and we are oblivious, and we just go down this path of looking at our smartphones all day and then following in some social mantra of blind faith, and it never ends well.
Yeah, I think that you've hit the nail on the head, that because we haven't opened our eyes to even consider what is up ahead, you know, what is the road up ahead? What is the probability and what are the possibilities? And until we do, and listening to this podcast, listening to some of the other podcasts that you've been talking to people about from so many different aspects, and yeah, we could talk forever because you've got a lot of knowledge and a lot of wisdom and a lot of experience. It's podcasts like these that just start the seed to grow. So the idea of, oh, maybe I should be looking at something else. And then, you know, once you're looking for something, you'll find it. You'll find all the different ways, all the different paths. And I think what's important is when people are telling their story. So having you on this podcast telling your story, it allows people to see that there are different routes that you can go. And so if you were to share with us, I know you've got a project on the go right now, I think that might help sort of as an enticement and as an example of what is possible if you choose the contrarian route. So what have you got on the go right now, Miles?
I bought a bullfighting ring in central Mexico. Okay. Yeah, that's, I'm not an animal cruelty. I'll explain. Okay, so I'll get to the point real quickly, but I need a little bit of a backstory. Okay, when I was a teenager growing up in Australia, we grew up on the coastline, and one of the greatest experiences I ever had was learning how to surf. And if you've ever learned how to surf and how to be out in the ocean with waves, you understand that you can't fight nature. Nature beats the crap out of you, particularly if you try and fight it. And I started realizing that there are patterns of things that go up, things that go down, and particularly in waves. And I also realized where the sweet spot was, where you had to position yourself ahead of a wave. You had to paddle like crazy. And if you did that and you picked the right one, it would pick you up and nature would give you its bounty and you'd have the ride of your life. And that's basically the underlying mantra of every single thing I've done in my life, particularly in things like investments, choosing technologies, picking horses to bet on, whatever it might be. I've always looked at being in front of a wave and being picked up by its nature, by its natural occurrence. So Mexico, I see, and this is Miles talking from a pragmatic, punting, futurist perspective. I believe that we as a society in the last 25 years have sold ourselves out for cheap products because we're not willing to face the reality that things, good things cost money to have, and that inflation is being, we can combat low interest rate policy by central banks and central planners if we can just keep getting cheaper crap to buy. And what we've done is we began that process in the mid-90s, and we perpetuated it all through. We started with outsourcing labor, things like, you know, call centers in India and programmers in the Philippines or whatever. And then product manufacturer went to China. So we outsourced to the cheapest possible manufacturing for the lowest quality product. And we created a society which is in effect a Walmart store where every single thing in there has been made in some other country, mainly China. And now they completely control us because we are so tethered to that supply point that if they put the price up, it hurts us. If they change policy, it hurts us. And what we've had to do as a society, as a human race, is we've had to look at behavior that we would never normally in the history, particularly in the United States, the history of freedom and the history of capitalism and so on, we would never have put up with things like humanitarian crisis and the Uyghurs and overthrowing Hong Kong and all of that that has been going on in our complete purview. We would never have put up with that if it was Russia. Now, we changed that a little bit with Crimea, but for the most part, we would never have put up with that in the 80s in the Cold War, right? We would always be flexing to try to keep them at bay and stop them doing that. But with China, they got a pass. And they got a pass when they entered the World Trade Organization, and they continue to get a pass day after day after day. This is not a statement against Chinese people. This is a statement against communism. We as a country have rejected it historically. All of the Western world has. And yet in this particular case, we turn a blind eye to it and we say, it's okay. It's China. We'll take their cheap products and so on. Mm-hmm. I saw this behavior changing about 10 years ago, and particularly in the last, say, 6 or 7 years ago. It changes by political variation in Washington. It also changes by things like COVID. We see a world crisis unfold upon us, and we see the origin of that crisis not being willing to be transparent. And as a result of that, there is a lot of pushback on China. It's not getting any better. It's getting worse all the time. And meanwhile, we still are addicted to cheap products because, God forbid, you have to pay $100 for a pair of jeans or a Barbie doll, which is probably what it's really worth, because that would affect our wallet, that would drive inflation up, and that would be the emperor has no clothes, so to speak, when it comes to central banks. And our society, our economy would collapse. I mean, it simply would. It's the one and probably the only one lever we have left other than money printing out of central banks that gives us a chance to ratchet back some level of inflation, because if your dollar's not buying as much, that's okay. Buy cheaper stuff from China and you'll still get what you want, but your dollar's not buying as much. But we can ignore that the dollar's not buying as much when you can go and get the cheap $5 Barbie doll from China. Okay. So with that said, I looked at this whole thing and thought, you know, I see in my home country of Australia how China's influence has gone in there and how it changed their culture. And in 2019-2020, Australia rejected China outright, particularly over COVID, took a very, very hardline stance against China. China then stopped all exports from Australia going in. They shut down the farming industry. They completely decimated the country economically by flexing their muscle and saying, well, if you don't agree with what you've got, let's show you how life looks when you don't have us. And the Australian people had to suffer under that. And I, as an Australian, I saw that. Now, that said, I looked at the United States and realized if they try that technique here, we need a plan B. And what I give credit for in the creativeness and the persistence of the American id is that this is a country of problem solvers, right? And if you've got a potential problem where you want to mitigate risk, the best possible way you can do it is to diversify. That is, you find other points of supply chain that will satisfy your needs. Right on our border to the south is a country of 130 million people who are willing to work, maybe not so at the Chinese level of pricing, but somewhere down in that range, certainly cheaper than we are willing to work in the United States or as in Canada as well. And what I see here is a return back to an idea that we can get through this if we just have close allies that we can buy products and have them shipped in because we're not willing to buy to build at that price point. And yet our economy can't afford for motor vehicles to be $150,000. We have to buy our parts out of Puebla in Mexico to keep the price down so that you and I can afford to buy a car. Mm-hmm. And the reality of all of this is until we do robotics and automate everything in the United States and then find a home for the displaced workforce, the truth is we need an interim position, a plan B that negates products coming from China, but gets them from somewhere else, particularly somewhere where there's not a transport issue, where it's close and where we have a friendly relationship. With that mindset and knowing the waves, you know, the surfer mentality, I went to Central Mexico and I started to, over the course of maybe about 11 years, but particularly more so in the last four, I started to really immerse myself in the culture of Mexico. I started to understand the people. I started to understand the art. I understood the embracement of family, la familia, the food, the whole beauty of what that country had to offer. And I realized it was exactly what the mainstream media was not telling you. It wasn't a bunch of drug cartels who would behead you at a moment's notice. It wasn't that. Those messages were set to shock and awe you on the nightly news that you will get through it to the commercials. And what would they sell you at the commercials? Well, it's the pharmaceutical ads and the insurance companies, right? Yeah. The two things that you would buy in the case of a crisis and a calamity that they've just created, right? So I looked at the whole thing and I said, this is fiction. I know from, you know, what's going on. So then I looked at where the industrial centers in Mexico and how they were ballooning exponentially in size as all of the things that I thought would likely happen as a result of what I was seeing geopolitically were happening. I went to towns like Querétaro, which used to be a small city, and now with these mega industrial growth, the fastest growing industrial city in Latin America, every European car manufacturer is there making products. Nestle's there, Bosch is there, Samsung's there, everybody's there, and they're all making products. Why? Because they can sit on the back of the USMCA or the old NAFTA agreement, and they can ship the product into the United States, and they're not going to get tariffed as if it came out of, Frankfurt. So I thought, oh, and look at what this has done to the society, what it's done to the economy, what it's done for the people. It's created wealth and prosperity. It's pulled people out of poverty. This is what a rising economy looks like. This is what Shenzhen, China looked like in 1995. So if it went that way for them, I'm going to punt. And so I looked at Mexico and I looked at, and I found havens of expats. And what I found was a common theme that a lot of the expats have. They couldn't afford to live in the United States because they got to their retirement age and they couldn't survive on their Social Security. See how I'm connecting dots, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, I know. Life expectancy, Social Security, money. They worked all their lives. My father, blah, blah, connect. And what happened was their only option was to move to Lake Chapala or to move to San Miguel de Allende or to move to Puerto Vallarta or something like that and buy an inexpensive property and live for $1,500 a month. And guess what? They can live like kings. And it's like, oh, hello, there's your answer. So, Miles, what happens when you've got this massive influx of baby boomers who can't afford to retire? You've got an economy which is there strategically to serve the needs of US consumption at the expense of Chinese consumption, and you're close enough that you can get down there in 2 hours on a plane. I think that might be worth investing in. So I went down there and I looked at property, and I went particularly to San Miguel. That's the town that I bought in. And I went outside of the town knowing that it was growing and growing and growing as I saw all this going on. Beautiful old 1500s Spanish provincial town. I mean, absolute postcard stuff. It's like going to Madrid. It's not the Mexico you think it is. It's like going to Europe.
Wow.
I discovered some property outside of it. And I bought one that had a bullfighting ring on that nobody wanted because they saw this big bullfighting ring and they're like, I don't want that. This big concrete structure and it's horrible. But I saw through that and I found demo crews and architects who have just gone in there and completely removed everything and returned it back to its natural land. It has the most beautiful views. It's got the most beautiful weather. It's got the most beautiful botany. It's a postcard.
Paradise.
It's paradise. So I bought it and now I'm building a very large home on it, some casitas. And finally, I'm getting to fulfill a goal that I've had for 25 years. And that is to build a world-class recording studio on that property to entice musicians and artists into San Miguel to be able to record the best work of their lives. And to be authentic to the artistic culture of Mexico, but to use modern technological methods, but to pay homage to the past. And that's what we're building right now.
That sounds exactly the way I'm dreaming the world to be going, to get back to what's important, to support each other, to live in harmony and to thrive. And it sounds like you're doing exactly that. I'm really excited for you, but I'm also excited because it isn't going to be just you doing these things. When people realize that they can create something in their lives that would make a difference to themselves, to their family, to the world around them, that's the kind of world that I think we should all be focusing on. There's too much that is fearful and scary in the world. We can turn away from that. You focus on telling people to turn off the TV and stop watching the news and stop watching the ads. And I do the same thing because that's going to keep us in this small-minded frame of mind that is going to slow down or close off any opportunities of getting out of that rut, that life expectancy should be the whole point. The whole point of our talk today is for you to see the listener, for you to see the big picture of what's up ahead for you. And if you don't like what you're seeing, there are different avenues to go, different doors to open. And I know, Miles, on your website, you have a forum for people, a community for people to get together. And can you tell us what that is? Is it about talking and having conversations with people? Or what is that all about?
It is about community. I've never been somebody that says I have all the answers. I don't. I'm just very observant. And I'm willing to make statements about what I see through my eyes that may have a different filter on it than everyone else. But at the same time, I respect that other people's filters and other people's life experiences change the way that they see something. And I want to know what that is. I particularly creative people, unusual people, people who don't think like the average Joe. And what I needed was a way that people felt they had permission to express the things that were deep on their minds that were maybe not shared universally. And so they couldn't go onto Facebook or to Twitter or places like that and make these statements. They weren't trying to be incendiary. They weren't trying to throw, you know, acid out there. They were trying to say, hang on a minute, this doesn't feel right to me. And is anybody else feeling it like this? And I think what happened was over time, I started to create this kind of resonance that people started tuning into that frequency. Mm-hmm. And then I also realized, being a technologist, that the one reason why I wanted to get out of the technology business was that I saw it centralizing. I saw it going to the big tech Silicon Valley firms. And firms that I've had long experiences with, I mean, I've been up at Apple many times. I spoke on their campus to their people on at least four occasions. It's not a problem that I have with those companies, but I know those companies when they were in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, when they became these mega corporations with the M&A and the big acquisitions and you know, the big Facebook things where they want to own the world and Google wants to control thought. And I looked at humans, right? I looked at our psychology and I looked at our flaws, because we have to admit we have them. And I realized, you know, we have ego and we have fear of missing out and we have fight or flight and we have all of these traits that are deep in our psyche. And I found that technology became a haven for some of the best and some of the worst. And it didn't ever filter these things in such a way that we as a community had say, because, you know, the content guidelines on YouTube, for example, are controlled by YouTube. And Facebook's community guidelines created by Facebook. They're not created by we the people or by democratic or majority rule. It's by what they think is appropriate. And I saw so many channels that were being shut down all the time, you know, shadow banned or just demonetized or blacklisted or just shut off. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, look, I know some of these goofballs are out there saying crazy things because they think that's clickbait and they'll get more people watching their shows. But sometimes it might be that 95% of it is that, but there's that little 5% in there of something that's real. And it's like, oh, thank you for saying that. I reject the other 95%. That little 5%, the fact that you were able to say it has helped me progress to a secondary point of research or whatever. When they get shut down, I realized freedom of the press, freedom of speech, the things that I came to this country and accepted willingly. It wasn't a birthright for me. It was something I had to stand in front of a judge and swear allegiance to, that those things were being destroyed. And I didn't want to see it that way. So I have a long history in the open source movement in technology. And I believe that if you invent something, you should give it to people to use. And I went back to my roots and I discovered some technology that supports those principles and are open source. And I'm lucky enough that I have my own data center here in Phoenix. We built a data center back in 2007. It still runs to this day. I have spare capacity. So I decided that I would build my own server for these types of discussions. It's built on a technology called Matrix. It's what they call a federated technology. So whatever somebody posts, it replicates. So you cannot be censored. You cannot be banned, but it's not owned by big tech. And that, the people not being scared to talk about things and to let the community work these things out organically has made this server very popular. And people are now on there talking about all different things. But there's no conflict. I mean, it's not like some Twitter comments.
They're a little crazy these days.
Yeah, they are. But I can honestly say the people on our servers are good-hearted people who question the same things that I questioned. And I think, I mean, that helps, right? We all are looking for answers. The problem is that we are our own worst enemies. And I would say that I'd mentioned before the kind of this principle of summation that I'm starting to see now as I put pieces together. You know, we humans have this position of ourselves being as if we were godlike. We don't respect where we are, our planet. I'm not trying to sound all crazy kind of climate changey liberally. I'm not like that. That's not me. But what I am saying is that we don't respect the fact that we're just another species on this planet like everybody else, and we don't work synergistically with nature. Now, I was raised in a country where a spider on the ground will kill you, and a snake in the grass will kill you, and a jellyfish in the ocean will kill you. So you learn up close and personal. And I've been in ICUs having been bitten by similar things. Mm-hmm. You learn up close and personal with respect.
Right.
In the same way that I learned respect for the waves in the ocean, and I learned respect for bushfires, and I learned respect for farming and organic produce, and I learned respect for my fellow humans. It's the exact same thing that we are forgetting in a world of urbanization and concrete jungles and technology. And I'm not saying that those things are bad. They're good. They offer a lot. They offer better transportation options, better communication options. You know, a market is now a supermarket rather than a farmer's market. I mean, there's so many advantages. Amazon next day delivery. I mean, come on, this stuff's cool. But while we're enjoying it, we've forgotten what the concrete structures were built on. And we've forgotten that we're just another species. And the most important thing, and this is where I think that we are so at risk in terms of our longevity. And this is one of the things that served me, but the realization of this has made me wealthy, and it's served me very, very well. And it's given me hope. And that is this one thing in the universe, which we can never, ever forget, that all things in balance, yin and yang, positive, negative, up and down, left and right. The sun rises in the morning and it sets in the evening. The moon rises and it sets. The waves go up, the waves go down. However godlike we might think of ourselves as a species with our electric cars and all of the things that we've got, we cannot ever forget that the universe is about balance and polarity. It is all about us. The sound that we're talking with now, the fact that you can hear me, is because of resonance in sound, which is a sine wave. It's about resonance, up and down, everything in balance. When you forget that the universe always returns things to balance, that's how it exists. And you start playing godlike with that, and you think that mathematics and money printing and all the things that we as a society are doing to try to stop the reality that all bull markets have bear markets, and that you push aside the universal principle of balance, it will be at your peril. And one of the reasons that drove me to Mexico faster than I probably normally would have was this sense that we have been so out of balance with the concept of up and down economic cycles. For the last 12 years, it's been nothing but ride the good times, you know? Mm-hmm. The universe doesn't work like that. Everything has to have a natural balance. And you can look at a chart and say, oh, since 1929, the stock market's gone up, 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 up. Maybe, but that's fiction. The truth is it goes up and it goes down. And that contrarians like myself make money when it's down. That's when we buy things. And when it's up is when we sell things, like the surfer riding the wave. And if you forget that the natural cycles of up and down polarity, yin and yang, that have existed far beyond us as a species, even beyond our planet, that all things in balance, if you don't have a north and a south pole of the planet working in unity equally, the planet will not spin. And when it doesn't spin right, bad things happen. And the reality is that we forget this, and we forget it at our peril. And if someone was to say, Miles, what are you trying to do? Like predict the future? Is yeah, because I'm trying to buy something now that's a bargain so I can sell it in the future. That's how I've made my money. And if I understand that all things in balance, it tells me the game plan right there. If the market's way up and it's been up for a long time, it's going to crash. When it crashes, that's when I can make my money on the buy at the bottom, right? It happens this way.
That's right.
And I think that we have just fooling ourselves with our phones and with our 21st century technological distractions, and we're doing it at our peril. And at some point, we have to return ourselves back to who we are, why we're here, what we do with our lives, the things that make us happy, our families, our passion about what we do, our creativeness, the great things about our species. We have to be able to get back to that. And if we just distract ourselves away from even thinking about it because, oh, I've got a meeting in 5 minutes I've got to get to, and my smartphone tells me to put the garbage bin out, and, you know, so-and-so has just commented on my Twitter feed and upset me. If this is how we're going to live our lives, it will be at our peril.
Thanks for listening. And did you know that positive reviews from listeners like you help me get these messages out into the world? Leave a rating for Own the Grey on your podcast app or at ownthegrey.ca. This episode brought to you by Lunch with a Healer podcast. The best conversations happen when you're having lunch with a friend, especially when one is a healer. Pull up a chair at lunchwithahealer.com.